I am Planta on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. Michael Chabon joins me from Toronto this day. His newest book is described as a shy manifesto, an impractical handbook, the true story of a fabulist as well as an entire life in parts and pieces. Its title is Manhood for Amateurs, the Pleasures and Regrets of a Husband, Father and Son. I must admit, when I saw the book in the publisher's catalog in the spring, I wanted to read it simply for the title. I didn't know anything about the author or his prolific career, which includes best-selling books such as The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, Wonder Boys, and The Yiddish Policeman's Union, and a Pulitzer Prize for fiction for his book, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. He's also a screenwriter, having written Spider-Man 2, which friends of mine who know about these sorts of comic book-turned film say is the greatest one ever. Manhood for Amateurs, though, is a fantastic read. It's beautifully written, often funny, sometimes poignant. And as a man, I found it fairly instructive. The website is michaelchabon.com. Manhood for Amateurs is published by HarperCollins. I'm very pleased. Welcome to the Planta Online program, Michael Chabon. Good morning, Mr. Chabon.
Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good yourself.
I'm doing well, thank you.
How many kids do you have?
I have four children.
And how old are they?
The eldest is 15, and she has a younger brother who's 12, a younger sister who's 8, and a younger brother who is 6.
And in terms of your life at the moment, it's obviously that they're your life. Does raising them and
yes. I mean that's a lot of people.
Yeah.
And they each have their own narrative, and so that's a lot of narratives. And then throw my wife and me into the mix, and we have a dog too. So. There's a lot going on in my house.
Yeah, and so your wife is a writer as well.
Right.
How do you find time to write when you have to raise four children? I mean, it seems hard.
Well, that's why school was invented. thank God for that. If for no other reason, it gets them out of the house. And after they leave in the morning, that's when my wife and I go to work. And I also work in the evenings, too.
Yeah, I read...
After they go to bed.
I read in the research that I did on you, that you had that you staked out your time for writing between 10 and 3.
Yeah,
but that's changed, has it?
Well, it kind of comes and goes. I still, especially if I'm bearing down and I'm working under deadline, I will sort of revert to that pattern and work late into the night, and my wife kind of. Has to step up and pick up the morning slack because it's hard for me to get up in the morning when I've stayed up that late.
They say this is your first major work of nonfiction. There was a collection last year.
Right, Jobs and Legends.
Right. As someone who's never read your novels, one assumes that there's a bit of you in them. But this book, it's all about you. Do you find it easy to write about yourself?
Well, you don't have to do a whole lot of research.
Yeah.
That's a good part. I don't really... I guess for me it's not really about being easier or harder to write about myself or about other people. I kind of take it on a sentence-by-sentence basis, whether it's fiction or nonfiction. I go one sentence at a time and then one paragraph at a time, and sometimes it's easy to write sentences, and sometimes it's hard, and it doesn't really seem to matter whether what I'm working on is fiction or nonfiction. It's just the individual sentences and then the paragraphs that you build out of them that sometimes come hard and sometimes easy.
The role of father, son, and husband in this book, it seems to me, for you, it's just one big role. For other men, do you think...
The Kaiser role.
Yeah, yeah. do you think we don't achieve manhood without all three for other men?
What, without all three what?
Without all three parts, the role of father, son, and husband.
Oh, no, I mean, you don't need to be a father or a husband to be a man at all. I don't think they're, requirements... by any means. I think it'd be pretty tough to be a man without being somebody's son, but the other two are fully optional. But they are certainly as caught up in our cultural culturally received, culturally inherited notions of what it means to be a man. You know, once you become a father, you discover all of the, you know, this whole sort of wonderful new world of stereotypes and cultural norms and expectations awaiting you, just as they were awaiting you when you were becoming a boy, becoming a teenager, a young man. You know, at every step of the way, there's this whole wealth of things that people around you and the world around you seems to expect or not to expect from you as a man, and that holds equally true when you become a husband or a father.
And adhering to traditional gender roles, did you think that's changed in terms of being a man?
I think it has changed some, yeah. I don't think it's changed as much as it should change, and I don't think it's as much as it's changed as much as we might have imagined it was going to change when it first began to change in the 1970s and when it first sort of became culturally acceptable for, you know, men to care for their babies and even possibly stay home to do that, and you know, that kind of a new model of fatherhood and manhood came into existence with women's liberation, I think inevitably with women's liberation in the 1970s, and at that point, I think it probably seemed like the sky was the limit. I don't think we've gone anywhere far enough along in terms of men both being expected and in a sense expecting themselves to have the kind of full, intimate, physical and emotional relationship with their children that women have always typically had with their children. But we're getting there.
There's a scene in the book where you're taking one of your children to the grocery store, and a woman comes up to you and says, "You're a good dad," without
right.
really knowing anything about you.
Right.
Do you think you found that odd because you can't take a compliment too well?
No, not at all. I found it offensive, but the reason I found it offensive was because I find it offensive, or at least annoying, to be praised for things that I, you know, either am not doing, in fact, or you know, have actually no control over. So it just, you know, to praise me as this woman did, as kindly intentioned as I know she was, to praise me for doing absolutely nothing, for just standing there, holding my kid in my arms, thinking nothing having to do with my son's welfare at the time, and doing nothing to foster that welfare apart from, you know, holding on to him, you know, it just bugged me. I mean, I didn't let on. I didn't tell her it bugged me. I said thank you. I, in terms of accepting the compliment, I think I did it fairly, you know, graciously. But inside, it really bugged me because, you know, I actually work really hard at being a good father, and I want to be a good father, and I wouldn't mind being praised for being a good father at a moment when I felt that's actually what I was doing. But, you know, to be praised for simply being physically present as a father, I think is just, if nothing else, it's pathetic that should be praiseworthy.
But don't you think, though, that there are a lot of fathers who aren't present and maybe...
Yeah, but that's not, I mean, that's not a... of course, but that doesn't mean that just simply being present is
means, you know, that it's
is praiseworthy
thing.
In
yeah.
itself. You got to be a lot more than just physically present to be a good father.
You write in the book that a father is a man who fails every day. Do you think that or know that, or does someone tell you that?
No, believe me, that is, you know, lived with wisdom, if you can call it wisdom. I mean, that is just a routine experience. You know, I think a mother is a woman who fails every day, for that matter. I mean, I think failure is a constant in the experience of raising children. You're always, you know, a day late and a dollar short. There's always a sense of insufficiency, no matter how much time and attention you lavish on your children. If you can manage to do that, you know, it's not, they'll take more. It's never enough. They're sort of a bottomless hole, and as much attention as you pour into it, they will never be filled. So, and what's more, you know, you're trying to hold your children to kind of a standard of behavior and conduct, to raise them up to be good and decent people who take other people's feelings into consideration before they act and that sort of thing. But on the other hand, you're also, nobody's perfect and nobody really lives up to the standards, and so you're failing at that all the time, and your kids are witnessing that failure, and so then you also have this whole hypocrisy element thrown into it where you're saying, do as I say, not as I do.
Does your writing and whatever introspection is involved there, does that affect the role of the parent or husband? Like, are you a better parent because of your writing?
Well, on the balance, probably it's a wash, I'd say. I think I have had my beliefs, my thinking crystallized and clarified for me by virtue of having written about aspects of fatherhood, of raising children, or of being a husband. Maybe I've codified a few principles or come up with a more coherent point of view, and that has helped me going forward in dealing with situations as they arise thereafter. On the other hand, my writing literally and physically takes me away from my children. I have to go out on book tours. I do a lot of travel, speaking engagements, and stuff like that. I'm gone a lot. I'm physically absent a lot because of my writing. Not to mention, actually the work itself taking me away. There are many times when I can't do things with my kids because I have to work. And so, I think the writing giveth and the writing taketh away.
You mentioned earlier the hypocrisy of being a parent. Mm-hmm. We see that when your daughter asks you about Beatles lyrics.
Right.
And the subject of drugs comes up. Is it easier talking to your kids about drugs or sex?
Well, I think for me it's much easier talking about sex because there's a lot less hypocrisy involved, and I feel like, I can... I know pretty clearly what I think they should do and how they should feel about sex, and it's something that they need to wait to do until they're emotionally mature, and when they do it, they need to be safe about it, and I can teach them how to do that, and I'm willing to be open and honest and talk about the kinds of things that arise in when once you become sexually active, and whatever slight sense of embarrassment I might feel about that subject, it's pretty easy to get over it pretty quickly. Maybe a little bit harder for them to get over their embarrassment and having to talk about it with me, but I think in a way the principles are pretty clear. It's about respecting yourself, respecting other people, respecting your body. And also having fun. I mean, all of that goes together. Sex is fun, and I don't mind telling them that as well. With drugs, it's much more complicated, much more difficult, because everything is just completely so heavily steeped in hypocrisy at every level that it's a very tricky conversation. Because if I give my kids a kind of draconian, censorious, abstinence advocating kind of conversation about drugs, I'm being complete hypocrite, since that's not at all what my experience was with drugs, or has been with drugs. It would also be denying the fact that drugs too can be fun, especially if we're talking about marijuana. I actually much prefer that they would, use marijuana than that they use alcohol, which I think is much more dangerous and has caused a lot more harm in the world. But if I'm appear to be condoning or tolerant of drug use, then I'm going against almost every prevailing cultural message that they're receiving in every other context, and that's going to create a kind of cognitive dissonance for them. And then there's just this huge societal hypocrisy we have about the ways that different kinds of drugs are treated, and that, yes, alcohol is legal and can be advertised and so on and so forth, whereas marijuana is illegal and you know, this our society itself is so confused on the subject that it's just it's much harder to figure out what the right thing to do. And even if you agree with your children and you were to decide, you know, it's fine for you to smoke marijuana and, you know, just, you know, get your work done and be at your appointments on time and so on and so forth, it's incredibly illegal and they could, you know, be arrested and sent to prison. So, you know, and who's going to want to advocate for that? So it's hard, much harder to know what to say about drugs.
One of the things that I found interesting in the book is you also talk about how different your children have been raised. And the sort of children seem different nowadays than when you and I grew up. You grew up in the 70s. I grew up in the sort of late 80s, 90s. They've grown up in the last decade or so. Do you find that kids are, I would say, sheltered more in terms of physical activity and then intellectually that they're a lot smarter than you and I were?
You know, I don't know if it's really so much that kids seem different to me as that the circumstances of childhood itself have changed, the conditions of childhood itself have changed. I think kids, the ways in which kids respond to the conditions they find themselves living in are probably going to be pretty much constant across time. Because children's minds work a certain way, their development proceeds in a certain direction, and they tend to be motivated by the same kind of things, usually having to do with the acquisition of candy. And I don't think that's, you know, changed at all since I was a kid. But what has changed is the circumstances in which they are permitted to operate, and they just have far less freedom. It's not simply physical activity, and of course, you know, kids are playing plenty of sports, and they're, you know, and all playing soccer and baseball and football and all that kind of stuff. They're running around, but they're doing so in a highly organized, highly stratified system that is completely run, managed, and refereed by adults. And that's true with every other aspect of children's lives, from infancy on through teenage years. Kids' lives take place in an environment now that is completely mediated by adults, that is created by adults, that is licensed, sold, marketed, and operated by adults. And it's very difficult for kids to find ways of having experience in a world that is an entirely a children's world. And I don't know how it was for you growing up, but when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, I spent vast portions of, certainly during the summertime and on weekends, vast portions of every day in a world in which there were no adults whatsoever, in which everything was kind of run by kids and along the principles that had been established for that childhood world over a course of many generations of children. And the games that we played and the things that we did would have been recognizable to children of, you know, many previous generations. That world is largely gone now. And, you know, it was a dangerous thing, certainly. And, I mean, parents today are so fearful of the danger, and I would never be one to stand up and say it was perfectly safe. It was dangerous. It was scary. There were mean kids, and bad things happened, and you could get hurt, and traumatized and teased and bullied and all of that stuff. It was completely lawless in that sense, or it operated according to its own kind of law that was potentially always a dangerous situation. But it had so many benefits as well, you know, that's what I really wonder about, is the effect of living in a completely adult-mediated world on children. And we've never really seen that before until this generation, so we'll find out.
Do you ever think about what kind of parents your kids will be?
Sometimes. I guess the thought I would be having more commonly would just be wondering what it's going to be like to be a grandparent, rather than, you know, how my kids will be as parents. You know, I hope that they get as much out of being parents of my grandchildren as I get out of being their parents, their father.
Your former father-in-law, you write about, there's a piece in the book about him and about your relationship. I thought that was just, I mean, I've been thinking about it for the last, ever since I read it. You know what I mean?
Thank you.
Yeah. Has he read the piece?
I believe that he has, yes. I never talked to him about it directly, but although I have seen him a few times over the years since I wrote the piece, I heard from other members of the family that he had seen it and he had appreciated it.
You dedicate the book to Steve Chabon, your brother.
Yes.
He was at your first child's birth, and man, that's just a great piece, the story of our story.
Thank you.
Yeah. The relationship that siblings have, how does that relate to being a man?
Well, I mean, the only kind of sibling that I've ever been was an older brother. To another brother. So that's all I really know about. And there's no question that being an older brother, entailed...
Do you become a man faster, do you think?
Well, I don't know if you become a man faster, but I had to learn how to... I had to be a certain way, I think, that is not all that different from the way you have to be when you're a father. I kind of always had to present myself as an authority, someone who knew what he was doing, someone who knew where he was going, someone who knew, how to do what needed to be done. And there was always a certain emotional price attached for me to feeling like I didn't know what I was doing or didn't know where I was going. You know, I didn't like to let on or show that to my brother. He really looked up to me. He's 5 years younger. And I always wanted to be worthy of that regard. A lot of those kinds of feelings definitely play out when you become a father and you assume that same or similar kind of role, for better and for worse, with your own children.
Who's a man that you admire that by the way that he comports himself, that you model perhaps, that isn't an amateur at this?
When I was growing up or now?
Today, it's someone that we would know that
the first person that comes to mind is the President of the United States, Barack Obama. I admire, leaving all questions of, politics and policy and all that aside, just as a man, I really admire him for his poise, his calm demeanor, his reflective demeanor, the way he seems to hold off reacting until he has a full understanding of what's going on. I think that is a real virtue, not just in a man, but certainly it is an extremely useful and necessary skill to acquire. There's just a kind of... there's also an ability to mock himself, to poke fun at himself, to not necessarily hold himself up as an authority, to acknowledge doubt and uncertainty. That is much rarer in kind of male role models than the first quality I mentioned. I mean, we are used to seeing men who take things in stride or grace under pressure. That kind of thing is kind of a conventional aspect of what we might admire in a man, somebody like a Steve McQueen, for example. But that additional quality of admitting that you're wrong, admitting to having made a mistake, admitting that you don't know, that's tough. That's a lot harder. It comes a lot more with a lot more difficulty to men, I think, than it does to women. And that's something I also see in Barack Obama, that ability.
What are you working on now, Michael?
I'm working on a novel, and I've been doing some screenwriting work too.
Yeah, this is the project for Disney, I understand.
I just finished up a project for Disney, and I've actually finished up two different projects from them, and one of them is going forward into production, which is pretty exciting.
Yeah, all the appearances that you've done for this book, whether it be on television, radio, or in person, like you're doing tonight in Toronto, it seems that you're reading from the book a lot. Do you enjoy doing that?
Yeah, I do. I mean, that's kind of what you're supposed to do when you go out on a book tour. So that's what I do. I mean,
it seems odd though that like a book is meant to be read and you're reading from it. I just found that I like reading the book better than, and it has nothing to do with you, than listening to it for some reason. I don't know why.
Well, I may not disagree with you on that subject, and different writers do some writers do a better job of reading aloud from their work than others, and sometimes hearing a writer read aloud from his or her work can actually really enhance your appreciation of it. I've had the experience of having read something by a writer and thought it was, you know, nothing special, and then heard the writer read it out loud and realized it was a lot funnier than I had. It was meant to be funnier than I had taken it to be, and in fact, it is a lot funnier than I thought it was, or that there was a greater amount of drama in it than I had really given it credit for having. That does happen too. But, you know, people become writers. I'll put it the other way. People, generally speaking, don't become writers because they like being performers. So it may not be the most natural thing in the world to ask of a writer to be a gifted reader aloud of his or her own work. But no, I do actually enjoy it. I have a certain amount of the ham in me, and I enjoy having the excuse to ham it up a little bit.
Well, Michael, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. I've really enjoyed the book, as I said. Continued good luck with it.
Thanks, Joe. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. The book is called Manhood for Amateurs, The Pleasures and Regrets of a Husband, Father and Son. It's published by HarperCollins. His website is michaelchabon.com. Michael Chabon on the line from Toronto in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.